once again, my friends, to the Global Gale podcast. My name is Philip O'Connor, and you are listening to the podcast for the 70 million Irish people in the Irish diaspora around the world. You may have been born in the island of Ireland, you may never have even visited it. We have the broadest possible definition of Irishness here, and we are here to celebrate the people in that diaspora around the world, their skills and their success stories, and we're delighted to bring you a podcast just about every week celebrating their achievements and what they are up to. This week we have another brilliant guest, right? But on this podcast, we're all about telling you how the sausage is made, right? You will have noticed there that last week, ahead of St. Patrick's Day, I hope you had a brilliant St. Patrick's Day wherever you were. We were here in Stockholm, and there was a bit of rain during the parade and that kind of thing, only to be expected in March in Scandinavia. But it was a brilliant day out, some brilliant Irish companies who were supporting it and everything else, and that was fantastic altogether. And there was a parade in Malmo, and there was an event in Gothenburg, and sure, I saw you all in Chicago and Sydney and all over the place on the RTE News. It was brilliant. Now, we had planned to have this podcast out last week, but unfortunately, lads, over the last little while I've been sick, right? Here's the story. I got COVID twice last year, right? Once in July and once in September. And I was the kind of fella now going through school, never got sick once, right? Never had a cold, never had anything wrong with me at all, right? Never missed a day in primary school, none of that kind of crack at all, right? And then I got COVID for the second time in September. And since then, my immune system is on the floor, right? Every little sniffle that's going, I'm getting it. And it's knocking me out sometimes for a week or 2 weeks at a time. Now, there's certain days that I'm grand and I have a good bit of energy and that kind of thing, but I may not be able to do a podcast because I'm coughing and sneezing and spluttering, you know, so we just never got it out there. We barely managed to squeeze out the last one that we did with Lauren, and indeed actually it was my good friend Molly Breen, who works for me on the podcast for International Women's Day, she ended up presenting that one, and it was brilliant altogether. If you haven't heard it, Lauren is a tremendous writer of songs, and she's a great singer, and she writes musicals, and she's had great success in London and New York and in San Diego and all over the place. So go back and have a listen to that one when you're done listening to this one. Yeah, but the result has been that we've been kind of knocked out of kilter a little bit in terms of the podcast, usually trying to drop it every week on a Wednesday or a Thursday kind of thing. And then it got to last weekend and we just didn't get it out in time. And then St. Patrick's Day happened. And it's only now, sort of late this week, that I'm feeling well enough to be able to do this again, because BJ's has been a busy enough time. But that's the lie of the land there. Anyway, listen, before we get into the conversation with the brilliant Irish photographer, Holly McGlean, Holly is based in London, right? And we actually have a live show coming up in London on Tuesday, the 16th of April, at the Irish Cultural Centre in Hammersmith. Tickets are now on sale. The first guest I can reveal to you is going to be Joe O'Neill from the Irish Creative Collective in London, right? Joe was our Global Gale Person of the Year for 2023 for the work he does with Irish creatives in London, right? Not specifically young people, but mostly young people. He does absolutely brilliant showcase nights for comedians and musicians and musical theatre. And again, if you go back to last October, I think we paid him a visit there. They were at the Toulouse-Lautrec restaurant in London there doing one of their showcase evenings, and I went there and I interviewed a load of people, and I just saw firsthand the amazing work that Joe was doing with this community. And Joe was an actor and a comedian himself, and he gives so much to so many other people, and I want to get him up on the stage, and I want to get a good audience there to give him his flowers, as the young people say. To give him the credit for the great work he does, and you know, to have that come from the Irish community. Tickets are on sale now from the Irish Cultural Centre in Hammersmith. Go onto their website and they'll do it. And if you wouldn't mind, do me a favour, lads, right? Because being sick and everything else like that, we're a little bit behind in what we're trying to do, right? We're confirming the other couple of guests are going to be on. One is a huge Irish sports star. We're hoping that they'll be able to make it. And there is another community organisation set to join us as well. So there's going to be at least three, maybe four guests on the night, and they're all fascinating people like your good selves there in London, Irish people abroad with great stories to tell, right? But please, if you see anything on social media for the Global Gale podcast or on my at Philippa Blana feed on Instagram or wherever you happen to get this podcast, right, please share it and help us reach as many people as possible, because it's only about three and a half weeks to go now, and we want to get the ticket sales going, because as I say, if you want to honour people in the community, you want to get the community to turn out and to be there, you know. I'd hate to be sitting there with Joe O'Neill and, like, you know, his ma and his brother Kevin sitting in the corner kind of thing, you know, because we can do that in their gaff. Then we don't need to go to the Irish Cultural Centre, brilliant and all as it is. So yeah, if you could spread the word and we get as many people down there as possible. The tickets, I can't remember exactly what the tickets are, but they're not very expensive anyway, so come down. It'll be a great old Tuesday night, and we're hoping then that what we'll get is a load of inspiration for a load more podcasts that we can do throughout the year when we go back to London. I'm sure maybe we'll even record one or two while we're there. Listen, I mentioned before the wonderful Molly Breen, right? Molly works for me as the business development manager of the podcast. And she does great work altogether, finding sponsors and putting together packages and doing social media and finding guests, right? So she was the one who dug up Lauren Gaffney for the last podcast, right? Lauren is the musical writer, but she's also a Malahide girl like Molly. And Molly has these brilliant suggestions for guests, right? And it's so great to have somebody in the office who just has a completely different perspective, probably because she's less than half my age, lads, right? But she's also interested in different things, because if it was left up to me, all you'd be hearing on here is footballers and boxers and fellas who play the Ilan pipes, and that's probably about it. Fellas who make craft beer and have beards like myself, you know, that kind of thing. But Molly is brilliant, because she'll go, no, you have to have this woman on, you have to have this fella on, you have to have this fashion designer, this photographer on. And she brought Holly McGlynn to my attention. Now, Holly is somebody that I knew who Holly was, right? I've been familiar with her work, I've seen her in fashion magazines, that kind of thing before. But I kind of, sometimes you think, Jesus, you know, how would I ever even go about reaching out to that person? And Molly sorted all that out, and the next thing she says, right, we're bringing her on the podcast, you're going to talk to her on this date, right? So about 10 days ago we got on the Zoom, and I love talking to photographers. Those of you who know me well and have been following these podcasts for a while will know that I do a lot of work in journalism and news journalism and that, and there's nothing I love more than when I go away to the Olympics. And then I get to sort of, you know, share a room or share an apartment with a couple of photographers, the great Dylan Martinez and Mike Blake from Reuters. I shared an apartment with them, I think it was in Beijing in China. It was in South Korea a few years ago. And I just sat there hearing all their war stories and lapping it up, and then hearing about how they think about photographs and how they put them together and that kind of thing. It's fascinating conversations altogether. And I have to say, the conversation with Holly was another one of those brilliant conversations with a very creative person. And it's also interesting from the point of view of how to build a career when you're abroad, right? Because we have our own little network, much like Joe O'Neill and the Irish Creative Collective, but there's also a lot of legwork you have to do yourself, and you have to be very flexible. And I think that's one of those things that comes across in this interview that you're about to hear with Holly, is how she keeps her eye on the ball at all times. And when COVID came along, and when things change in business, and when things move fast, she moves just as fast, if not faster, to make sure that she remains at the head of the pack. Right, so here it is, the interview with Holly McGlynn. I really hope that you enjoy it as much as I did talking to her, and I really think you're going to. Holly, there's loads of things to talk about. I love talking to photographers. You'll find out why in a minute, right? But could we just maybe start with how you fell into photography? Was it, you know, a thing from an early age where you went, oh, I'd love to be able to do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. No, I came to photography a little bit later. But actually, when I think back, I did get a camera from my parents for my 6th birthday, which I remember asking for a camera because I wanted to take photos. But I suppose I had that sort of short-lived photography career when I was 6. But then I didn't come back to it until after I'd finished university. I moved to Berlin because a friend of mine was living there, and went to visit her. And I was like, this is the coolest city I've ever been to. I'm going to move there. And so I moved to Berlin, and I just got really into photography while I was there. And bought my first camera there. And I thought, okay, actually, this is really what I want to do. And so I moved back to Dublin after having spent a year in Berlin. And my flatmate in Dublin was a film producer, and she was like, we need a stills photographer. Do you want to do it? And I was like, okay. And then I sort of spent a year building up a portfolio. And then I started to look into masters in photography, and I found a master's in photography at Goldsmiths in London. And so I moved to London 16 years ago to do that master's, and have been a photographer ever since.
Brilliant. I have to ask, right, because you said, you know, you were done with university when you moved to Berlin. What education did you get at university that you subsequently just fired out the window in favor of photographer?
I did an undergrad in history of art and French at Trinity, and I loved that. I absolutely loved it. And I was trying to think, what can I sort of practical career can I get out of this? And I thought I really wanted to work in representation for the arts in Ireland. So I then went on to do a master's in public relations. in Dublin, and I ended up meeting my husband on that course. But then I wasn't too sure that that was what I actually wanted to work in, and so then I thought, yeah, sure, I'll move to Berlin. As you do. Yeah, so that was kind of my convoluted journey into it.
Well, it's still kind of related. I mean, photography is art, you know. I'll kill anybody who says, you know, that you get a lot of these people go, it's a trade, it's a trade. No, it's an art, right? So did you find that there was a link, you know, what you studied as history of art, French, you know, parts of the manual, certainly, maybe, like, you know, but did you find that useful when you did move into photography?
Yes, well, the master's that I did at Goldsmiths of it was kind of, well, part social documentary and sort of visual anthropology is how they like to put it. And then the other part was fine art photography. So definitely I had a really robust understanding of art and how to apply that to photography. And so I spent my first couple of years as a photographer, as a fine art photographer, and I was represented by a contemporary art gallery in Dublin, and I sold my photos there, and then I also exhibited in spaces in London as well. But ultimately, I found it quite lonely being a fine art photographer. I really like working in teams. I like producing lots of work. I like having deadlines. I like being collaborative. And I've always loved fashion. And I think fashion at its best, fashion photography at its best, is like fine art photography. So I made a sidestep into fashion photography probably about 13 years ago now.
How would you describe your style? Because again, you know, somebody might look at your photographs and they go, yeah, okay, I see that. I enjoy that. You know, I see what she's trying to get at here. Is it something that you built like Lego, or is it something that you fell into?
My style. Yeah, I think that it's a natural evolution. I didn't set out to build it in kind of style, as you say, like Lego. Yeah, it sort of evolved naturally. But yeah, I my style has evolved over my career as well. But I would say in general, it's like feminine, feminist, bold, colorful, with a sense of humor. Is generally how I describe it. And I always use flash as well.
You always use flash. That's one of those things I'm absolutely hopeless at using. I may as well just throw mine in the bin. I have no use for it at all. When you describe your style as feminine and feminist, I find this fascinating, right? How do you embody that? Because it's so difficult to take an idea that's in your head and then turn that into something that's on the screen or on the page or on the billboard that looks like what you wanted to do. So how do you go about making that a reality in your photographs?
Like from concept to realization.
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I always say this because I also lecture in photography and fashion communication as well. And you know, this is a frustration that lots of my students have. And I say this is a frustration that all photographers have and have had throughout their careers as well. So you're in good company. And I remember kind of when I was an emerging photographer, having an idea in my head of a photo and then trying to execute it and just not being able to do it and being so frustrated by that process. And it was only sort of further down the line, I was like, oh, well, I'm trying to create something of like an image I've seen by a photographer that maybe has 20 years more experience than me. Like, why am I being so hard on myself? And I kind of slowly, I just realized like good photography takes time, and it takes time to perfect a craft. And I don't think you ever really perfect it. It takes time to hone a craft. So I think it just kind of takes time to get to a point where you're able to make the photo that you want a reality. And I wish I had, you know, something more substantial to say, but it just sort of all clicked into place one day.
Yeah,
And that's the magic of photography, really.
well, that's it. I think it's sort of, you know, it's underrated how much experience matters in these things. It's not knowing the right thing, it's knowing the right time to do the right thing and that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah,
C
absolutely.
c could I ask you, if we go back to that time in Berlin, I think, where you said that was where you bought your first camera, what sort of a camera was that? Because I'm envisioning you now running around the streets of Berlin with a sort of a point and shoot, doing
Yes.
street photography. Was that the kind of thing you were doing?
Yeah, that was exactly it. It was very cheap, point and shoot, digital camera, not an SLR, like one of those lenses that zooms in and zooms out when you press like the plus button. So yeah, it was very rudimentary, but I think you can take great photos with any camera. One of my favorite cameras to shoot on is a disposable camera that you would get in a pharmacy. And I've taken some of my favorite photos on those kind of cameras with the plastic lens and the inbuilt flash. So yeah, I just did my best with it, really.
What in that case then? Because you're talking about that's a very basic camera, right? You go to Boots or whatever, you buy that camera, you take the pictures, you develop them. If you're me, half of them go in the bin, and then the other half follow them about 5 minutes later, you know? But what are the principles behind using a basic camera like that to take a good photograph, would you say?
Excellent question. I
Straight
don't know
card.
if I have the answer. A lot of photography is intuition, I suppose, and I think you kind of just have to follow it until you hit the sweet spot, really. And I think before digital camera became the mode of photography that everybody uses, the film photographers, the great film photographers, they just practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced until they sort of built that experience and that knowledge of what took a great photo. And I've spoken to photographers who used to develop their photos, and they'd look at the contact sheet and they'd always say it was around exposure 15, 16 that was the one. So it always sort of took them about half their roll until they got it. So I don't know. I think it's just sort of trial and error, really. But a few basic things that, again, I say to students is the inbuilt flash on a disposable camera is not a powerful flash. So make sure that you're standing close to the subject. And I think, take advantage of the fact that this is like a plastic lens that you isn't going to be super sharp. The image is going to be soft focus. So try and exploit that and make the most of that. The image is going to be like quite grainy as well. So again, make the most of that. But yeah, it's frustrating. I would like there's lots of technical photographers out there who really like focus on the detail, but I'm more of a sort of emotional photographer, more of an intuitive photographer, which might sound like a cop out, but I'm afraid that is the fact of the matter.
No, it's brilliant because it's like when somebody asked me how to write something. I don't know. You just sit down, you
Yeah.
write the thing. I have no idea how I do this, but actually, one of the things I want to ask you about that, right? When I look back at some of the things I wrote 20, 25 years ago, I can cringe and go, day, right? Does the same thing happen with photographs that you would have taken?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was talking to some of my students the other day, and I was like, if I have the courage, I might show you my degree, pro well, my master's project from my master's in photography, because my cheeks go flame red when I look back at those images. But I think how amazing is that? Because it just shows how much you've evolved and how much you've improved and how much you've like dedicated on your craft and worked on your craft. I think it's great if we're cringing at work that we did. If we're not, it means we haven't moved on.
Are you kind to yourself when you look at them? Because we're laughing about it now, right? But sometimes you go, Jesus, if anybody ever sees that, I'm done in this business.
I've only gotten good at it over the past 5 years, I would say. I have, as a lot of creatives would be, I've been very unkind to myself over the years. I said I'm not good enough. Why would anybody want to hire me? I can't believe I took that photo. Why is everyone better than me? And yeah, it's something I've had to learn that hasn't come naturally to be kind to myself when looking at my work.
I love how you can feel like that about yourself and beat yourself up, and then you go to the biggest and probably the most competitive city in the world to go and work in this field. What is it like living and working in London? Because millions of people, there's any amount of opportunities. There's often I've lived in Stockholm for 25 years, and I so often get the questions like, why didn't you go to London or New York or something like that? Well, A, because I probably wouldn't survive there. So what is it that makes London so great for you and for your work?
Good question. Well, it is one of the biggest cities in the world. There is a lot of opportunity here. I'm doing a workshop in a couple of weeks at the V&A, and yeah, I like that's kind of the only place in the world where you can get an opportunity like that. I don't know. I guess London is not for everybody, but I just like it. I like the buzz. I like how many opportunities there are. I like the creative community here. There's always somebody that you can collaborate with. I'm good. One thing I am very good at is networking. I'm good at talking to people, and finding opportunities. And I suppose if you are good at those things, then London is a great place to be.
It is a central fashion industry, and fashion is a big part of what you do. How does that work, right? So if you have, I mean, you've worked for Chanel, you've worked for Elle magazine, you've worked for so many huge names in fashion, right? Do they sort of pick up the, you know, when they design something, they go, okay, this is the photography we want when we're putting together the catalogs and the ads and that kind of thing. Is it a long process, or is it you get a phone call the night before and you turn up at a warehouse with your camera and your flashes and 10 o'clock the following morning? Or how does that process work?
Yeah, it's long. It's long, very long process. And then there is the odd job where you might get a call the night before, and you think obviously a photographer's cancelled here. But yeah, I mean, I would say in terms of like Elle picking up the phone to me, like that's pretty rare. That's normally come from many months or years of hustle. There's a great London magazine here called Stylist magazine, really, really wonderful women's magazine. And I emailed them for 7 years before I ever got a commission from them. And now, I regularly shoot for them. My first sort of break into fashion photography was for a magazine that isn't in print anymore called Company Magazine, which is part of the Hearst Group. I emailed them for 2 years before I started shooting for them. So I think in terms of these places just picking up the phone to me, that I have put in months and yes, like I said, sometimes years of hustle to get to that point. But no, most shoots would be a lot of prep time, a lot of production and pre-production that goes into them. There's not very many shoots. Like if you're working in news or if you're working maybe on like a weekly or if you're doing this quite shortly. But in terms of fashion shoots, they would be generally be longer lead times.
You've used the word collaboration a few times in the conversation so far, right? Because obviously there's going to be like a marketing director, there's going to be an art director, they're going to have a vision, right? But they're bringing you in because you're brilliant at this too. How much conflict is there in shoots like that between you and the other creative people? And how do you work through that so that everybody gets the result that they want?
Yes, good question. As a photographer, I always say this, you're only as good as the creative team around you. So you could be the best photographer in the world, but if you're not working with like a stylist or a makeup artist that shares your vision, then your photos aren't worth anything really. So I think it's all about finding a creative team that shares your vision, and you can only do that by getting out there and doing like test shoots. Saying, finding a style and saying, hey, do you want to do a shoot together? Let's see how we work together. Same for makeup artists, same for hairstylists. So I think, and also for assistants as well, I think building that creative team around you. And then you can bring that creative team to the shoots because the art directors and the creative directors that you work with, they'll generally be dependent on the job. But if you can bring your creative team, then you're bringing your support network with you as well, I suppose. And I always try to establish an environment of collaboration on all of my shoots. So I let everybody on set know, including assistants, including runners, that everybody's opinion is valid on this set. If you have an idea for a shot that you think would look good, tell me. I'm not going to think that's inappropriate. I'm not going to chastise you for that. Your ideas are valid and they are welcome. Because there always comes a time on a shoot where you're like, I'm just out of ideas. I just don't know what to do anymore. And the model as well, you have to share your mood board with the model because if the model doesn't know what your vision is, how are they going to do their job properly? And that's when your makeup artist jumps in and says, oh, what if we tried this? So your stylist would be like, I think this would look really good. So that's one kind of element. And then in terms of making sure you're on the same page as the creative director or the art director, it's just about conversation, really. I don't think there's been anywhere really where I've had huge conflict with anyone because it is just about push and pull and giving a little and getting a little. But there was one shoot I was on many years ago, where I had been, I went through a phase certainly of shooting with coloured gels quite a lot, and it kind of became my signature style for a little while. And they had hired me because they wanted me to shoot this style. And we were shooting, and then the art director was like, they're too dark. We need them to be brighter. So we made them brighter, but it just you couldn't see the gels anymore. And I just thought, well, what is the point? This isn't the vision of the shoot. And I was like, oh, I'm not too sure, like, if that looks right. And they were like, no, this looks great, this looks great. And then, because I had such a great assistant who kind of we were on the same page as, they slowly, with each shot, were like turning the light back down. And then the photo went back to what we had originally, and the art director was like, yeah, boom, that's the
Fantastic. Sometimes that's all it takes, is just
one.
something small just to get it back on track, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But one of the things that is very important to you and your work and in the way that you run your business as a photographer is sustainability, right? It's one of these, it's a buzzword that every company is talking about now. I'm not sure many of them know what it means. How do you apply that? What does it mean to you and your work?
Yeah, so in 2019, I became quite involved in the climate action, climate justice movement, and started getting involved in community organization with Friends of the Earth and kind of educating myself on the climate crisis. And through that, I realized, the sort of catastrophic impact the fashion industry has on the planet. And I also was like, well, I can't really be sort of doing this work and campaigning for, say, garment workers' rights and then shooting for fast fashion brands at the same time. Like, that feels like a real conflict of interest. And then COVID happened, and so I wasn't working. And then I had my second child, so I was on mat leave. So I had a career break of almost 2 years. And during that time, I just thought, I'm just not going to go back to working with fast fashion brands. Because of that break, I was able to be more selective with the clients that I work going forward. So I said, I'm only going to work with sustainable fashion brands going forward. However, there are very few sustainable fashion brands. So I've had to expand my practice now to incorporate photography and advertise, sorry, not photography. I am a photographer, portraiture and advertising photography as well. I've also in that time expanded my practice further to do consulting, sort of comms consulting, sustainable brands. So not just on the visual side, but working with them on their PR and on their comms strategy as well, which I'm really enjoying. And then a year ago, I joined the Association of Photographers, which is a trade association for photographers in the UK. I joined their board of directors. And as part of that role, I am also chair of their sustainability working group. So trying to bring sustainable strategies to the industry as well through that. And like I said, I've been involved in community organization, but I've also been chair of a local government climate committee as well. So it's something like that is very, very important to me, not just in my work, but in life in general. I'm trying to incorporate it into my practice that way.
When you said to those fast fashion brands, or I don't know if you said it sort of, straight out, it's like, lads, either, book up or I can't be working for you anymore. Did any of them come with you? Did any of them say, Holly, okay, we should probably do this, or did they just go, oh, thanks very much, and get sort of the next person in the queue in? Did you find that that had an effect on any of your clients, or were you just happy to leave them behind if they didn't want to follow you on that journey?
Yeah, we never had the conversation actually because it was COVID, and then so there wasn't any shoots happening. And then I was on mat leave. And I guess, like, on my social media, I've been like really vocal about this. And I think, because my clients would follow me on socials, I think they just sort of thought we're not a fit anymore. So we never really needed to have that conversation.
Yeah, it's kind of like that person that you date three times and then both realize, yeah, no, let's not do anything at all ever again, kind of thing, you know. How do you find that now? Because I think it actually might have been this week sometime that you were chairing an event about sustainability for the Association of Photographers, right?
Of course, yes, I was, yeah.
So how is that? Because, like, you know, sometimes you get that thing of poor old Greta Thunberg here in Stockholm who's sitting outside the parliament for the last God knows how long with our
Yeah.
school strike. You know, some people could be very aggressive. They could be very almost violent. You know, they could be. Do you get that sort of thing in social media as well? Oh, who does she think she is telling us how to live? We can't afford these fancy brands that she's taking photographs of. We need fast fashion. Do you find yourself having to have those discussions with people?
I don't really I don't have an enormous following online, so no, I have everybody who I sort of converse with online are they're on the same page. I know there's lots of like big accounts that talk about climate justice, that talk about sustainability, and they have to engage with that conversation a lot more. But yeah, you know, through community organization, so not necessarily relating to my photography practice, but yeah, through co community organization, you do come up against that attitude as well, I suppose. And you know, that is fair. You know, sustainable clothing is more expensive. But there you know, access to cheap clothing isn't a human right. We should, you know, be buying a coat that lasts us 10, 15 years, not just like one season. And so I think we do need to have a mindset shift. And that's gonna take time. Yeah.
It is. You'll often hear young, especially the young people who are involved in the movement, talking about how climate justice and social justice are the same thing. And indeed, living in Sweden, that's the way things were until maybe 20 years ago, that people could actually afford to buy quality and therefore they didn't need to buy as much of it, you know?
Yes,
L
exactly. Yeah.
Let us pivot, right? Because you mentioned there about portraiture, right? That you're now taking portraits of people. You've expanded your practice to include that. How do you take a good portrait? How do you capture the essence of the person sitting in front of you when they sit down?
I think I heard Rankin, I think it was it in an interview or was it in a documentary that he did, and he said he was having a conversation with David Bailey, as you do. And they said it's half an hour to talk to them and it's half an hour to take the photo. So all in all, a portrait takes an hour. And I agree with that. I think 90% of a portraiture, good portraiture, is getting to know the person first. So I think it's really important to set aside time to chat to them. Now, if you're a celebrity photographer, you don't have that luxury. I do have a celebrity photographer friend out in LA, and he's like, I've got 15 minutes with them. but I guess the flip side of that is a celebrity can turn it on, and they can like they know how to do a good portrait themselves. But yeah, I think it's taking time to get to know somebody, making them feel safe. Is really important. Making them a part of the process, make them feel like they're creating the photo too, and they're not just having the photo done to them.
Do you like to put them in a situation that represents them, or do you just put them against one of those famous backdrops, you know? Or would you ever say, come on, let's get in the bus here, we'll go to, you know, Croydon, or we'll go to Glasgow or somewhere and take that, you in your natural environment, as if they were an animal in the zoo? Or do you just put them in front of a neutral backdrop and go, okay, let's see what we can get?
Yeah, it depends on the brief. But I shoot this series for Stylist magazine called Work Life, where they interview a different woman with a really cool job each week, and there's a portrait to accompany it. And yeah, they are what's known as environmental portraits. So you take a photo of them in their work environment. So, you know, I've photographed like the creative director of a ballet company, so I've taken that in the rehearsal space. You know, I took a photo of a bra fitter for M&S, so I took a photo of them like in the changing room, the bra department. You know, so it depends, sort of. Yeah, I really enjoy that kind of portraiture, but then I also enjoy doing something creative in the studio as well. So it all sort of depends on the brief, really.
Have you ever had to take a photograph, or make a portrait of somebody that you really didn't like?
Yes.
Don't name the person, but tell us a little bit about that experience if you would.
It was very challenging, actually, really, really challenging. And it was tricky to navigate. I think, well, again, having that really great creative team around you really helps. So I felt like I had a lot of support there. And staying patient, I suppose. And just, yeah, just getting, trying to detach and just trying to get on with the job. I don't know if I was successful or not, but I did my best.
When you look at the pictures afterwards, when you look at the photographs that you made that day, were you happy with them?
No, I wasn't. Isn't
How
that interesting?
much of that was technical, and how much of that was the fact that you couldn't get over the fact that the person was a dickhead?
I think it was just the disconnect from what I was trying to achieve versus, and you know, this is actually where I did fail. I was actually projecting a vision on them. I did, and they didn't want it. And you can see that they're uncomfortable. They were uncomfortable with it. So yeah, that was actually a failing of mine as a photographer. But I had a very limited time slot with them, and I just thought I just need to get this done as soon as possible. But actually, I probably should have pivoted a little bit and tried to include them a bit more in that creative process. But I didn't really, yeah, on that occasion. So that's an interesting reflection.
That's the most honest answer that anybody's ever given to a question on this podcast, and I really appreciate that. About the creative scene in London, right? There's a guy called Joe O'Neill who's been on this podcast. He's almost a regular guest here. He runs the Irish Creative Collective in London. We have loads of brilliant young Irish people going to London, theatre, musical theatre, photographers like yourself. What advice would you give to them after going to Berlin, buying a cheap camera and starting up? Is there a sort of a way? Are there things you should do when you get to London to make it in your chosen creative field?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I always say being a photographer is 10% taking photos. And there's a whole lot of other stuff that goes into supporting that 10% taking photos. I think you've got to, so I would reach out to your community first. So you might move to London and say, I don't know anybody, but like there's a London Irish Centre, there's a huge Irish community in London. There's the Women's Irish Network. There's so many different networks. One of the first sort of paid photography jobs I got in London was I shot the annual ball of the London Irish Business Society because a friend of mine was on the board and she was like, we need a photographer for that. Why don't you come and do that? And through that, I met like the Irish Post, which is a newspaper for the Irish community in London. And I ended up shooting for them. And from that, I got various other kind of jobs and I met other people through that. So I think like you can just start with one connection and it will build on that. So I think networking is a really key part of building a career as any creative, but certainly a photographer. And I know networking isn't easy for everyone. Like it does come easy to me, but I appreciate that it does not come easy to everybody. So, and this is something that I tell my students as well. Like spend some time coming up with a little elevator pitch for yourself. So just like two or three sentences about who you are and what you can do. And then like have a little business card or something you can leave with someone. So if you're a photographer, it's almost like having a, like a mini portfolio in your pocket because you could have your photos on one side and your contact details on the other side. Everybody laughs at me. They're like, we're in a digital world. Why do you have business cards? But I think that's what makes the difference is because it's like something tangible and people remember it. People don't remember who they've followed on LinkedIn or Instagram at an event they've met, but they will find that little thing in their pocket the next day. So yes, there because that having a little elevator pitch stops you from feeling awkward. You can just say your piece, give them a business card, and then you can retreat away. But I think, yeah, spend as much time building your network as you do building your craft as well. You've got to do those two things hand in hand. And I think also like you will fail. And you know, failing is part of the process. Failing is good. Failing is how you learn. So the main thing is to just pick yourself up and go again. And I think that's what I have done over, you know, a 16-year career as a photographer. I've been knocked down so many times, but I just always got up again. And I think really that's the key, just get up again.
Have you found yourself, you mentioned there the great jobs that you got in the beginning through the Irish community. Are you now on the other side of that, where you are the person that, you know, people will go, they'll find you online, they'll see you in Stylist or something like that, and they go, oh, Holly, I'm starting out as a photographer, you know, can you give me any advice? Have you become the sort of the elder stateswoman now in the photography community for Irish
Oh
people?
my God, I would love to be considered an elder stateswoman. What a fabulous title. Put that
I'll make a post of that and tag you later on, you know. An interview with the elder stateswoman of Irish photography in London. But is that network very important to you? Because it's very important in the beginning for getting us established. But it's something that we're lucky enough to have a very tight community here in Stockholm, where you just know if you need that and there's people there for you. So in a creative pursuit that you're usually on your own, is it important to you to have that behind you?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think community is just so key for in any aspect of life. And yeah, I'm so happy to share whatever I can with emerging photographers. And actually, as part of my role at the AOP, they have a mentoring program, and I've been mentoring emerging photographers as well. So yeah, I do that wherever I can. I think it's so important, and I get so much from that process as well. It's not just a one-way thing.
It's been brilliant speaking to you. I have just one last question to for you, right? And it's only a small one. What's your perfect shoot? Who or what would you really like to shoot?
My gosh, I'm asked this question all the time, and I never really have an answer. But an icon of the fashion world has just recently passed away at 102 years of age, Iris Apfel. I would have loved to have shot her. She's wonderful. So yeah, I've missed my chance.
I was just going to say, if you took a few snaps of her now, they'd probably be very interesting indeed.
But yeah, do you know, I need to start making a list because I'm always saying to my husband, I'd love to take that person's photo. I'd love to take that person's photo. And then whenever I'm asked the question, like on a podcast or an interview, I'm like, I don't know,
Was there ever a shoot like that that you regret that you turned down? Like somebody who went on to be mega famous kind of thing, when, you know, Kate Moss at 15, that, well, she's probably famous by then, but I don't know.
gosh, good question. Not that I can think of, not that I can think of. No, but I did. I mean, it's kind of the reverse a little bit, but I grew up, I was like Generation MTV, and I grew up watching the presenter Edith Bowman on MTV. And a few years ago, I was on a charity shoot, and we were shooting like 60 people in a day. It was really intense. I only had a few minutes with each person. And I was looking through the cast list, and I was like, oh my God, Edith Bowman is here today. And so I took her photo and I introduced myself, and I was like, I loved watching you on TV growing up, blah, blah, blah. And we got on great. And she afterwards, she was like, oh, I really need some portraits. Would you be interested? Do you have a card? And I was like, yes, I have a business card. Thank you very much. Like I tell everybody to have. And within half an hour, I'd heard from her agent saying Edith would love to work with you on a shoot. And so that's been a really nice relationship over the years. And I'm actually doing another photo shoot with her shortly. So yeah, there's been lots of lovely sort of moments like that throughout. But I don't think there's ever been one that got away that I can think of. But if I think of any, I'll email you after.
That is to your eternal credit, because we all make mistakes, and often they're mistakes of omission rather than commission, if you put it that way. So, Holly, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. If you're ever up to anything, if ever anything like that, please do come back on the Global Gale podcast. But for now, thanks so
Oh,
much.
thank you so much. It's been great. Thanks for having me.
There you go. That was indeed the wonderful Holly McGlean. And I often say, but geez, I could talk to her all day. Just such a fascinating person. And to see somebody in that situation who's built themselves up from a sort of a disposable camera or a point and shoot camera in Berlin into the career that she's had and the person that she's become now, working with all these industry organizations and taking pictures of everybody in the fashion business and everything in between. And also the sustainability aspect is very interesting to me as well, because it's one of those things, as I mentioned, interested when I was talking to Holly about it. There's an awful lot of companies talk about it and they kind of know they have to do something about it, but they don't really know what they should be up to, you know. And I think that, you know, what they see as being sustainable, and, you know, it sort of comes down to what actually doesn't affect the bottom line as much as anything else, you know. So, but it is one of those things that's not going away. It's something that companies will have to think about. And indeed, I think I was talking to somebody recently, was it Helen Kavanagh Bailund, I think I was speaking to on the Irish in Sweden podcast, and it's going to be much more a part of corporate life in the future. So it's going to be more interesting to hear what people like Holly have to say and the pivot that she has made in her own business. Right, lads, I will be off for the time being. Don't forget that event now in London, 16th of April. It's on a Tuesday in the Irish Cultural Centre down below in Hammersmith. We're going to send Holly a couple of tickets because she took part in this interview, and we would love to see you down there as well. If you're not in London, if you're in Sydney and can't make it, that's grand. But please do share the news that we are having a Global Gale live podcast in London on the 16th of April. That's it for this week. There's a fascinating character coming up. I mentioned Sydney there. There's a man coming up on the podcast next week who has cycled pretty much from New Zealand to Ireland, and we're going to be having a chat with him on the podcast next week. Until next week, my friends, I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can support it at patreon.com/arrowman in Stockholm. But until we meet again, take care of yourselves and take care of one another, and I'll be back very soon indeed, COVID and colds permitting, with another episode of the Global Gale podcast. Take care. Good luck.